to excuse, I have a little cold.
Oh, yeah.
Over,
well, you've so, got some, and yeah. got some water, so feel free. Good evening. How are you all? Oh, your microphone is off on the other side. Well, that's okay. But good evening. Our guest this evening is George Condon. And George, I have known for a number of years, and always enjoyed his reporting, and enjoyed him and called him a good friend. And so he was willing to come over tonight and talk with you all. And George is working for National Journal's publication Congress Daily. And he's going to he'll tell us about his reporting, and reporting is a career, and what it is like these days. But while we were sitting and waiting for us to begin, we were talking about an event that and I learned something I didn't know from George. We were talking about Martin Luther King's assassination and what it was like in Washington at that time. And he was talking about, he was a student at Georgetown, and he interviewed a student who, was he a student at the time?
Yes. Well, my first interview with him, and the lesson of this is pay attention to who you meet in college, because they might end up mattering later.
You're going to have to guess who the person is that he interviewed.
When I was a freshman at Georgetown, I was sent out to do, for the Hoya, the school paper, a memorable three-paragraph story to interview the head of the Student Athletic Commission, who was, Georgetown was upgrading football, which, very relative terms, it certainly wasn't Division I, but it was, they were going to give scholarships and so on. And the head of the Student Athletic Commission was bringing back the Georgetown football team that had played in the Orange Bowl in 1940 to show that we had once had big-time football. And that student who was head of the Student Athletic Commission was also notable because he was about the only non-Catholic on campus at the time. It was Bill Clinton was a big deal on campus, and he came up on the I saw him again at when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I did what a lot of students did. You know, the National Guard was roaming the streets, had machine guns set up at Wisconsin and M, and so there was a curfew. We got some beer before they closed the liquor stores and played cards through the next 3 days. Bill Clinton put a white cross on this Buick convertible that he had gotten from his stepfather, and drove into the worst of the riot areas in Washington, delivering blankets and food. And go figure, one of us ended up president and one didn't. So, you know, look at the person next to you, and you know, you might be getting a presidential appointment from him in 20 years.
Did you interview him about his time at the assassination of King?
I did years later, and we talked about that. Clinton was amazing. When I saw him 8 years after graduation, and there was no reason for him to remember me. I was a nobody freshman at the time. He was a big deal on campus, and I saw him at a governor's conference, and he remembered my name. If he wasn't under oath, his memory was absolutely incredible. And we also, the year that I was vice president of the White House Correspondents Association, I sat in between Hillary and Bill at the dinner. And at one point we got into, there was a lot going on with Bosnia that night, and generals kept interrupting us. But we started talking about a mutual friend from Georgetown days who had been on the Georgetown football team and later ran for Congress. And Clinton started talking about this goal line stand against Fordham. Uh-huh. You know, the Georgetown football was basically an excuse to drink in those days. You see a trend here, I'm sorry. But he remembered this entire goal line stand, and he started gesturing of Fordham running into this friend Pierce O'Donnell, and thrown back. And they said, this fat guy can't stop us. And he ran again. And people are gathering at the rope line. And they thought he was doing a Bosnia military strategy. And I was embarrassed later on to admit it was just a 20-year-old, 30-year-old Georgetown football game.
Yeah.
And I went back. I actually had bound copies of the Hoya in my basement, and I found them and read that game because I didn't remember it. Uh-huh. And he had three of the four plays absolutely uh-huh. right.
So, yeah. Yeah. Well, he was known for a good memory, yeah. Except selectively
yes.
here and there. How many presidents have you interviewed?
This is my seventh.
Uh-huh. And have you talked to Obama at this point? Have you talked to him?
Not since he's become president. Uh-huh. I talked to him in the campaign,
uh-huh.
But not as president.
Uh-huh. What?
But it's only 5 weeks.
Uh-huh.
Well, there's time.
I think you'll make it. What do you find that's special about interviewing a president, and how do you set up for it?
Well, I mean, the most important thing for a president or any interview is to do your research beforehand and know what you're talking about. I mean, and it's just, you're only going to have a limited amount of time with the president, so know what you want out of it and what mm-hmm. topics. The worst mistake I made in the presidential interview was I worked at the time for the San Diego Union-Tribune Copley News Service, and San Diego was hosting the Republican convention in 1996. So I had an interview on Air Force One with the president. It was the head of the nominee of the other party traditionally gives an interview to the host city newspaper. And all I wanted out of it was politics and how he was going to beat Bob Dole and tactics. And I made the mistake of saying, well, I'll ask one substantive question before I get to the politics. So we're sitting there on Air Force One, and I asked him about immigration policy, because that was important to San Diego. And the president said, well, let me make 6 points about that. And then he started talking, and he got to the third point, and I realized I was going to run out of time. But you can't really say to the president of the United States, I'll stipulate to the last three points. You know, if I don't care about them, let's talk politics.
Yeah.
And by the time he finished, I had time to really jam in, you know, only two uh-huh. quick questions, or three I got in,
uh-huh.
on what I really had come for. So uh-huh. I should have known that before then, but I learned a lesson of ask what you want, and
uh-huh.
don't assume that any president is going to give you as much time as they promise.
Yeah.
And President Obama is particularly disciplined on that. In the campaign, if they told you were going to have 7 minutes, that's what you got. And usually you could sort of filibuster and get more time with the candidate. But, mm-hmm. I mean, what marked his campaign and him personally was a great discipline.
Mm-hmm. How do you think they switch from one to another and segment those interviews in such a short period of time? I know that... that Obama one day did a series of 5 interviews with the television reporters.
Right.
He wanted to do all of them to talk about the stimulus program. But you can tell us what happened to those interviews.
Well,
designed to talk about stimulus.
Well, that's right. That, unfortunately for their timing, it was the day that Tom Daschle was forced to drop out. So that became the focus of the mm-hmm. questions. But, you know, they know they're going to get the same questions from every reporter, and they just have to try to make their answers look fresh. That used to really bother Ronald Reagan. He hated giving the same speech over and over again because it started boring him, and his staff mm-hmm. and Mike Deaver had to say, no, you know, this is the point you're making. And nobody was better at that than George W. Bush. When he ran for governor in 94, there were three points he wanted to make, and that's all he would make. No matter what reporters asked, he would make the same points again.
Uh-huh. When he ran in 2000, he was very disciplined about what he talked about
right.
as well. He had a campaign agenda, of about six items, and that's what he wanted to talk about. And in 2004, the last weekend of the campaign, I don't know if I can't remember if you were on the trip, but I did the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of that last weekend, and we went from Washington to New Hampshire to Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Florida, and he gave the very same speech. Exactly the same speech. There were no differences in it.
And, of course, at that point, you're not really reporting on the speech as much as you are developments, because they're not going to say anything particularly new. No, luckily, I wasn't on that. One of the benefits of some seniority is you don't have to go on the killer last week trips where, you know, for example, Bob Dole, he knew he was going to lose. Everybody knew he was going to lose. But he decided, I'll do 96 hours in 96 without any sleep. The candidate can slip off and get some sleep, but that's when you're writing your story.
Yeah.
It's like when you're on foreign trips. And I remember getting into the first, I was excited the first time I had gotten to Jerusalem. I'd never seen Jerusalem. We arrived at 1 a.m.
President?
This was Reagan or the first Bush? I think it was the first Bush. And we finished our stories by 3 a.m. and we had a baggage call at 5 a.m. So I had arrived in Jerusalem, never saw daylight before we had to leave. So didn't quite live up to what I wanted to say.
Right, yeah. It's not a good way to travel. Yeah. But tell us about your career, and if we can see it started early.
It's been misspent. It's been a failure. My parents are very disappointed. But
you've had a great career, and have worked in different types of media.
Yeah. Well, I'm from a newspaper family. My father, who just turned 92 and just finished another book. Was a columnist and reporter at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, 43 years at the paper. My youngest sister is a homes editor of the Plain Dealer now, and I worked at the Plain Dealer for a while. But when I graduated from Georgetown, I worked briefly for a weekly newspaper in Cleveland that Howard Metzenbaum owned, then at the Plain Dealer, and then went to the Columbus Bureau for the Plain Dealer, which is still the most exciting story. One of the tragedies of newspapers cutting back right now is that state capital bureaus are being trimmed. I mean, and that's where the public perception is completely wrong. The public thinks that the corruption is in Washington and that, you know, if we could just run things like we do in state capitals, we'll have honesty and light. There's far more corruption in state capitals, and far more influence by lobbyists. And yet every newspaper in the country is cutting back how much they're reporting. And the amount of corruption that's not being reported now is really bad for democracy. But anyway, I covered the Ohio State Capitol and then went to work in San Diego for the San Diego Union. So I got to cover Jerry Brown and California politics, which was fun. And then came to Washington in 82. Was with Copley for 30 years until, sadly, they closed the bureau just a few months ago. And I've been with Congress daily covering the White House since January.
What drove Copley to that situation? What are some of the dynamics here?
Well, I mean, it's a cliche, and I hate to use it, but it really is sort of a perfect storm for newspapers. You have a lot of newspapers foolishly spent too much on other newspapers, like Knight Ridder buying McClatchy, New York Times buying Boston Globe, Gannett buying Des Moines Register. Even the people that bought Reader's Digest, you know, paid $2.4 billion, way more than it was worth. So you have that debt they have to service. Then you have a generation coming up that does not have the newspaper habit, so you're not getting new readers. Then you have the technological changes so that classified advertising is where a lot of newspapers make a lot of money. Well, we foolishly let Craigslist innovate instead of us doing the innovating. We could have done that. Our ownership was not smart enough to do that across the industry. Didn't see it coming. Then you toss in the worst recession, which is leading to possibly a depression, which by itself would have had us in trouble because advertisers scale back. So all those things combine so that newspapers are not making the money that they need to make, so they try to scale back staff. So we had 11 people covering Washington for our newspapers. Then it went down to, three at the end.
What year was that?
We had 11 in 2005 when we won the Pulitzer Prize.
And can you tell us the story that you worked on?
This is a perfect example of something that only a regional newspaper would do. Because we had a member of Congress from San Diego named Randy Duke Cunningham. And everybody knew he wasn't very bright, but he was very conservative in a very conservative Republican district that revered the military. And Duke had been the only Navy ace since the Korean War. He was an ace in the Vietnam War, had shot down five MiGs, and that became his life. That's what he talked about endlessly. And they got him into Congress. And again, we knew he wasn't going to go into leadership because he really was, as I say, not very bright.
How did it manifest itself?
Oh, he'd just say incredibly stupid things. He also did crude things. He was in a room like this with constituents and a cancer patient, and his elderly man challenged him on why is so much being spent on the military budget and why isn't more on cancer research. And I don't want to offend the students by repeating what he said, but he went like that to him, and which is very congressional, giving the finger to an elderly cancer patient, and used the F word with him. Now, that's not bright.
That seems fairly suicidal an elected official.
He reminded me of a councilman we had in San Diego who, when they were debating putting in 9/11 as the emergency number, raised his hand in the debate and said, "Well, I'm confused." He said, "How are you going to dial that? My phone doesn't have an 11 on it." I said, 1-1. Oh, okay. So being smart is not always a standard for getting into public office. Duke got himself onto the Appropriations Committee and the Defense Committee, Military Committee. So he was involved with the contracts and earmarks, and a lot of that budget went into what they call the black budget after 9/11. So there was very little scrutiny.
Be intelligence and things that it wasn't going to become public.
Right. Yeah. And he ended up we got onto the story by accident because he sold his house to a contractor and the price didn't look right to us. Number one, it's unusual that you would sell your house not to another couple but to a defense contractor. And then the defense contractor sold the house 6 months later for $700,000 less. And what he had done, it turned out, they're all in prison now, was sell the house, and it was a bribe, pure and simple, to funnel this $700,000 at a minimum to the congressman.
Yeah.
And it turned out his greed knew no bounds. When I would imagine that every student here tonight probably bought a laptop, and you either bought it yourself or you asked your parents to buy it for you, you got it. Well, in the Cunningham family, it worked a little differently. When his daughter was going to college and wanted a laptop, the congressman called up the defense contractor and said, "Buy my daughter a laptop." And he did, charging the taxpayers. When the laptop broke, Duke called the contractor and said, fix it and buy our new one. When he wanted the car, he called the contractor. He wanted a little video game thing that
your PlayStation? Bought it.
Vacations, prostitutes. There was no end of it. There was one, I don't want to make this too long, but there was one story where we found the contractor did say no to Cunningham. They went out to dinner at a restaurant, the Capitol Grill here. Duke told the Vietnam stories again for the millionth time. They went to his boat that another contractor had bought for him to live on in the Potomac here. And in the warm weather months, Cunningham put a hot tub up on the deck, but he was either cheap or too stupid to know how to fill it with clean water, so he would just siphon water out of the Potomac and fill the hot tub and never change it in the whole season. And he had this mistress who was a Baltimore flight attendant, and she was there that night, and the contractors came over, and they're all wearing coats and ties. And then Duke got up and said, well, let's go in the hot tub. And he stripped naked, which was not a pretty sight. This guy was out of shape and, you know, in his 60s, and wanted all the contractors, you know, to join him in the hot tub naked. Yeah. And that's when look at the hour. it's time to go. And they just drew the line. They would not get into a polluted hot tub with a naked congressman.
Corrupt
They'd
congressman.
Give him millions of dollars, but they would not do that. They had standards. So yeah. Anyway, we wrote the stories. And the beauty of the story was there were no leaks, no tips. It was everything on the record and documented. And within an amazingly fast amount of time, he was convicted of the most corruption in the history of Congress, or as our book said, the most corrupt congressman ever caught. Both contractors that bribed him were in prison. Another contractor in New York is in prison. And the number three guy at the CIA who was also involved in it was just within the last 5 days sentenced to prison for this.
So, how long did it take you, how many of their of you were there? And how did you organize the coverage, and where did you start?
Well, it started with just there was one guy that deserves the credit. Although when I was looking for a job, he told me that I should stop giving him the credit. I should take it. But the credit really belonged to Mark Stern, who is now working for ProPublica, which is an online investigative reporting thing that provides stories for other publications. Mark just didn't believe Cunningham on some filing about who had paid for trips. So he started just on the internet finding out everything he could. And Mark considers this a failure because he never did nail down why Cunningham went to Saudi Arabia on a trip. But out of frustration, he said, I'm going to launch a lifestyle audit. And he just wanted to see if any money, any change in his lifestyle. And everything was online in the San Diego County. Property records is where he saw the house sale, and that just he just followed that and went to the website of the company that had bought the house. It was listed as, I think it was 525 New Hampshire Avenue Inc. out of Las Vegas, and we recognized that as a Washington D.C. address.
Yes, right.
It was the address of MZM. Contractors, which also had 525 Connecticut, New Hampshire Avenue.
Oh, I see.
So it's just that and then developing sources and just following the records.
So. How long did it take?
Oh, and also helped that when that Cunningham gave him an interview and said things in there that were provable lies that we could prove.
When did it start?
Started in May of 2005, and the first story in June, and then a series of stories that followed very quickly.
Did you start with the house?
Yes.
And when did the government get involved?
Oh, the U.S. The deputy U.S. attorney in San Diego. The story appeared Sunday morning. He went out for his run, bike ride, which took him past Cunningham's office, came back, looked at the story, and immediately called the U.S. attorney and said, we want to start. And there was an investigation within 24 hours where three U.S. attorneys were involved in subpoenas and raids on the congressman's house, boat, and office. And actually, one of the things they found on the boat, which they didn't know, the FBI didn't know what it was, and thank God one of the contractors, realizing he had been caught, told him what it was. It was what they call the bribe menu. The congressman and the contractor had gone to lunch, dinner, I forget now whether it was lunch or dinner, at a restaurant in Georgetown on Wisconsin Avenue, the grill, the Metropolitan Grill.
For the Daily Grill?
Daily Grill. And Cunningham wanted to make clear to him what he expected in bribes. So, because he had to pay off something on fixing the boat. So he listed on one side of congressional stationery how much money he expected, and in return he'd get how many millions of dollars in contracts in earmarks for him. And it was in sort of shorthand, so the FBI didn't realize what it was. But once it was explained, you know, how many congressmen are stupid enough to do a bribe menu on their stationery? So, I said he wasn't very bright.
And when was the trial?
It was within a year. I actually don't remember the exact date.
So it was fast.
It was very fast. Because the evidence was so overwhelming.
Yeah.
And you know, the contractor knew that he was caught. You know, he helped the prosecution to get a shorter sentence. But Cunningham ended up with an eight-year sentence, which is the longest sentence any member of Congress has ever gotten. Mm-hmm. It would have been longer. They did cut a little off because of his war service.
And what kind of resources did that require from the newspaper? Was everybody in the bureau here involved?
Actually, it didn't require that much after the initial. So, I mean, we had a lot of, you know, reporters in San Diego who wrote other stories off of it and about the San Diegans, because one of them was, and they did a lot of good reporting on the defense contractor there. And we did a lot on how Congress operates and earmarks and broadening it to other congressmen.
I think we could see this this year or last year about the pay-to-play scandal in Illinois, the importance of corruption at the state level, and it is very disconcerting to think that we're going to lose so many newspapers. And what do you see as the alternative for digging out these stories?
You know, there isn't a good alternative right now. I mean, and there was some good reporting done on the Cunningham story by one blogger, Josh Marshall at TZM, the Muckraker, did some wonderful reporting. We credited him when he broke things, and he credited us. So, you know, I am not one who says there's nothing good being done on blogs, because, I mean, Josh proves that wrong. He's far and away the lead. But the reality is most of what you see on the Internet is linking to newspaper stories. And there are very few places that can throw the resources into stories that newspapers can, where you can, you know, in some cases, not in ours, but to devote 2 years to developing a story. Because you run down dead ends. We could not have done the Cunningham story if we had not had the commitment to covering congressmen on routine things. Because we knew Cunningham, we were suspicious when he gave an explanation of why he had gone to Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. We knew it was a lie. He said he had done it to have better relations with Saudi Arabia. And we knew Duke well enough to know that there was no way in the world he cared what the relations with Saudi Arabia were unless there was something in it for him. And, you know, nobody, you take newspapers away covering members of Congress and regional issues, there's nobody that's going to do that. There's no, there's a very good San Diego web newspaper and some good bloggers, but none of them can afford to be in Washington, D.C., and following the routine. And if you don't follow the routine, you don't get to know them and to see the signs of corruption or the good things. I mean, we have members that do good things for the community. And, you know, that's just not going to happen without newspapers. I mean, TV stations have basically pulled out. The Chicago Tribune last Friday closed its broadcast operations. If you go to Richmond, Virginia, there's almost no TV coverage of the state capitol now. No, I mean, forget whether newspapers are arrogant and deserve their fate, because there's an element of that. There has been arrogance there. It's just a question of what's good for democracy if you have nobody watching agencies or your public officials and how your money is being spent.
Do you see any hopeful signs?
No. No, I'm sure there are, but with this recession, I mean, things are very bleak. I mean, I got a call this morning before I left home from a reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, which had been the one regional newspaper that had been holding out and not doing layoffs, and they laid off 45 reporters this morning. Well, actually, there are hopeful signs. Politico, for example, is doing a very good job of of covering and filling a void. I mean, they have four or five people at the White House now.
Seems on a daily basis they have at least
and
four.
And some of it is breathless. My favorite was last week when the president was going to address the nation that on Tuesday night, and early in the day they posted something, 2:42, six motorcycle police are now lined up outside the White House waiting for the motorcade tonight. Now, I admit that newspapers had missed that story. We did not know how many motorcycles were parked outside the White House.
Or particularly interested.
No, but they do a very good job. On the campaign, Politico was one of them. And other websites like that have popped up that are, that are filling the void.
And in their case, they have a newspaper, so it's their newspaper that's really generating
the revenue.
That's right. Any revenue they have is through that. And so now you're working for Congress Daily. Tell us what Congress Daily is like, and how is gathering news in what ways is it similar, and what ways is it different?
Well, it's different style of reporting. I mean, it's there. Instead of a mass circulation newspaper, Congress Daily has 20,000 subscribers. So the audience that I'm writing for example, covering today the president's meeting with the British Prime Minister. And I love foreign policy. I've reported from 88 countries, and I love watching foreign policy develop. But, you know, our subscribers, which are members of Congress and lobbyists and other reporters, you know, they have no interest in whether there is a special relationship between Britain and the United States.
Wouldn't they be interested, say, if there are going to be some kind of contracts involved? Readers.
You know, I'm so new to the organization that that hasn't come up yet. But but they did care that the president was talking about the economy in there, and that's what I went heavily on. And we do have an impact. I would write something for San Diego, and it would often have no impact at the White House, but you write something about the president's actions infecting Congress, and every member of Congress is reading it, you have an impact.
Do they read it online, or is it printed, and when?
Well, it comes out twice. It is printed, and you see people carrying it around on the Hill. But the PM edition that comes out in early afternoon seems to have the most impact. Again, I'm so new to this, having just started in January. I'm
Yeah.
I'm sort of learning it. But I've been accused by other reporters of having a bias where I don't recognize Congress as a co-equal branch of government, and that I'm so White House-centric that that's the only thing I recognize. And there's an element of truth to that, I suppose.
Well, except, but you were writing from the White House. So
right,
that's
right.
And that's what they expect, is to have the White House angle.
Yeah, the last time I went to the Hill, a friend of mine up there offered to do a map quest for me so I could find it. But
how do you find out your news, and how do you develop stories, and is it different now than it was, say, at the San Diego Union?
At San Diego Union, we were more focused on leaving the daily stories to the wires and not duplicating that and doing more longer or regionally focused stories for Sunday, where the most readership. Here, there's not as much focus on that. It's the immediate, what did the president say this morning?
And the backstory of it.
Yeah, but there's a lot more immediacy of getting the news in.
So when you first started, what was the length of a story? And what is the length of a story now?
Stories are a lot shorter now than they used to be. And that's true throughout the entire industry.
Because the paper's smaller.
I mean, we used to write, it's embarrassing to see how long they were, but, when I would start, we would write, 1,800 words on a presidential speech. Nobody does more than 800 or 900 now. Mm-hmm. I mean, readers do not want to read long stories. And we lack discipline on that, and we've learned, and they're shorter now. Now, there's some stories that do merit. When the Washington Post wrote about the mistreatment of veterans at Walter Reed, those stories deserve length, and that was important. But I mean, our first Cunningham story that ended up with five people going to prison was under 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. Like I say, no source, no leaks, just facts that were very easy to follow.
And those are the kinds that people can understand pretty easily too.
Yeah, there was nobody had a hard time understanding somebody overpaying $700,000 for a house.
That there was definitely something something wrong.
And it turned out the people that had known about that corruption before us were the neighbors, who all couldn't figure out why it sold for that. Now, none of them called and said anything, but they weren't surprised at the story.
At what point did you talk to the neighbors?
Early on.
How do you find out your news? What do you, what are your habits? What do you read and when do you start?
I get delivered to my house the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and USA Today.
And then, when do you start reading them?
When I get up. And before I go in, and I read the I try to read the Post and USA Today at home, and then I read the New York Times and Wall Street Journal on the metro coming in.
And do you do do you do Politico?
I do Politico several times during the day, and
Do you do
Romanesco?
Romanesco comes in, at least in mine, it comes in around noon. And it always brings bad tidings of the news industry.
Right.
It's about the industry, and it's which paper has gone under today and what were the particular issues with it.
And I do Drudge and RCP.
That's Real Clear Politics.
Right. And they're aggregated. I mean, you can see links to stories that you want to read in other publications. And the Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times has a blog, everything about Obama. I take a look at that. Although she's been sort of focused on Roland Burris in recent days. He's the story that keeps on giving for Chicagoans.
And he's going to continue, too.
Yeah.
He's keeping his feet planted right here in Washington.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then depending upon, you know, when I have time during the day, try to look at Huffington Post.
What do you do during the day in gathering news? You know, kind of, what do you do developing a story in the morning, and who do you talk to?
Well, actually, one of the things that I'm having a problem with, this is the first time where I've actually worked out of the White House basement, as you well know, near where you're sitting. And I'm not finding that as conducive to doing interviews and reporting as being at the office. For one thing, everybody can hear. If you're working on something you don't want to share necessarily, there are no secrets when you're working with 12 people in about a, 20-foot area, and your chair is touching three other people.
It is hard, and particularly because some of them now, at least that you know, the ones that are currently down there, have they have deadlines where they can move a story on a website, and so if you are talking about something that you don't want to talk about, because I know today I had to talk to somebody today because I'm going in tomorrow, and I didn't want to talk about the particular subject. Because it, because the reporter who's doing it, you know, it's his it's his story, and I knew that the story would get picked up, and so it's difficult. So in the cold weather, in particular, like it is now, you know, reporters can't just go out on the driveway. It's really cold out there, so people go up on the steps and have to sit on the steps to do their phone calls.
And you also have ethical challenges. I mean, about 10 days ago. One of our competitors, Politico, I heard him, you know, working on a story that is something that I cared about. You know, and it would have been unethical for me to then try to jump in and beat him to it or anything. So I had to sort of brace myself, knowing that was coming out the next morning. It didn't turn out as bad as I thought it was going to be. So, but he didn't have the key interview that I thought he had. So, but. But you do have ethical challenges on that. So I try to get back to the office if the president's not out of town and do the interviews from the office.
From the office,
but you still, I mean, you, no matter where you are, you're working the phones and calling people to find out what the president's going to do and why he did it. And I'm a little less interested in trying to, I'm not sure what the big deal is. If you get on the web 15 minutes before your competition, I mean, so what? I mean, I'd much rather have the story on why something happened that puts it in some context instead of, you know, having, you know, what am I going to do? Spike my BlackBerry and do a victory dance because I beat somebody by 40 seconds or something.
That
doesn't make sense.
But let's go to some questions.
Okay.
And you guys have some questions? All righty, somebody.
What are your obligations and responsibilities as a White House reporter, and what in turn do you expect from the president as far as his obligations and responsibilities to the public and to the press?
Well, I mean, you know, what I expect from the president, you know, I'd love to say give me a few exclusive interviews, but, I mean, all you want from a, as a reporter, from a president and from a press secretary is to tell the truth. I mean, let me bring it down from a president to a press secretary. We all know that, you know, I've covered probably 13 press secretaries, and I don't expect and never expected any of them to just answer every one of my questions. There are things that they shouldn't tell us that affect national security, that can affect the development of policy, can affect stock prices, people's livelihoods. But there are probably two dozen ways of saying no comment or deflecting a question. And I understand that. If somebody says I can't answer that question or uses one of the ways of getting around it, but don't lie to me. Don't, and some press secretaries have out and out lied, and not on matters of national security. You can get into a long discussion on national security and troops' lives on whether you can lie then. And once you lie, your credibility is shot, and we're not going to believe you on anything. And then it will get testy. It will get nasty, and it's a very bad relationship. Now, for a president, you just want him to do his job. He's not there to make my job easier. If he wants to, that's great. But you know, he should be just doing his job.
And what kind of obligation does he have to explain what he does to the public?
Well, a function of a good leader is bringing the people along with them. You cannot bring the people along with you if you are not a good explainer. And one of the things that we already see about President Obama is that he's a very good explainer. I thought that speech last week was very effective in explaining to people why some of his policies are going to be followed, what the ramifications are, that there are going to be tough times ahead. And here's why I share your anger about bailing out people who did stupid things, but here's why we have to get the credit eased up. Here's why it's important to you that we're doing these bailouts. He, of course, didn't use the word bailouts. So, you know, you cannot be a good leader if nobody knows why you want them to follow you.
Mm-hmm. I guess the corollary to that question was, what are your responsibilities to the public? Are you a reader?
Part of it is the same, to tell the truth. I mean, you do not to think that you're the story. I mean, for example, any reporter who starts whining about, you know, oh, it was so hard getting this story, and oh, you know, too bad. You know, nobody cares about that. Just do your job. You gotta, and you have to tell the truth and not have any kind of partisan angle that you bring into it. And people never believe us that we don't. I mean, in my own case, I have never had, in 30 years as a reporter, I have never had a discussion with another reporter about how we were going to vote. No matter how many beers we might have had on a campaign trail, never have had that discussion. I don't have that discussion with my own family. They don't know how I'm going to vote or how I did vote. It's just not something that you do. And when you see reporters sometimes going on cable and to keep getting invited back, they get a little too opinionated. You should do analysis, but not opinion. Nobody cares what my opinion is, but hopefully my experience or my reporting will make my analysis worth having. I don't know if that completely answers your question.
That's good. Another question here? Yeah, all the questions are going to come from Towson this evening.
The pressure is on.
Yeah, that's right.
What kinds of questions do you normally ask President? Is there like a set of questions that you normally go by, or do you look at current events and current issues?
Oh, well, I mean, it depends on what type of interview you're doing with. Had an interview with President Bush once where the President of Mexico was coming the next week. In San Diego, we obviously cared about that, so that was the topic for the interviews. You didn't ask anything else. When I'd have more casual conversations with the President, you might range from everything to why don't you read more newspapers, to baseball, to his approach to an issue, or how he thinks his presidency was affected by, you know, this event or that event. So it really, there's no set piece. If you're, one of the things that you always want to know is how a president approaches decision making. How does he think? How does he analyze? And that was, you know, couldn't have been more different going from Bill Clinton to George Bush to Barack Obama. And that's instructive and helps you understand a president.
Can you tell us something about that, how you figure that out, how they make decisions? Who do you talk to for that?
You try to talk to the people who are in the room mm-hmm. when he's making decisions.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Bill Clinton, extraordinarily smart and a sponge. I in 8 years as president, including, you know, we had dinner at the White House once, had dinner in Germany once, and chances to just talk to him in more casual uh-huh. settings. It was a personal goal to try to find a subject that he had not thought about.
Uh-huh.
And I failed. I could never find anything, no matter how obscure, that it turned out he hadn't read a book on or something. Mm-hmm. I once was pool reporter in Kansas City when he toured the Jazz Museum, and then we toured the Negro Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And I tried to stump him on that, on things on, you know, Satchel Paige's statistics. And he knew a lot more than I did on on all that. I thought I knew a lot about baseball. He blew me away on that. So, you know, you're always looking for that. But that led to a lack of discipline in his decision-making mm-hmm. because he wouldn't narrow it down. He would always want, like we were back in college and, you know, in the dorm, and he'd want a bull session mm-hmm. on it. So sometimes they wouldn't make the decisions when they should. Mm-hmm. And it would go on too long, and that wasn't good for government. George Bush, his curiosity was, when we were in St. Petersburg, Russia, and they put on a tour of the Hermitage Museum, one of the great museums in the world, fascinating stuff. And he was unhappy that they wanted him to spend 20 minutes doing it. You couldn't run through the Hermitage in 20 minutes. You know, he just had no curiosity on that.
Uh-huh.
He had set things that he believed. He was well-read, but, you know, did not want a lot of outside uh-huh. input on that. And Obama looks to be a very disciplined decision-maker from uh-huh. what we've heard so far.
So do you find that you can get to people on the inside who have been in a room, or do you have to find people outside of the building?
You have different success.
Uh-huh.
With Ronald Reagan, you had great success on that because there was a lot of tension and fighting among the top aides.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helped me because I wrote for a California paper and a lot of them were Californians.
Yeah.
So tremendous success with that. Pretty good success with George H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And okay with Clinton. Mm-hmm. Not good success with George W. Bush. I mean, they were Texans and disciplined, and they didn't want to admit mm-hmm. to any problems. They just didn't want to share anything other than, you know, God, the president is great. You mm-hmm. should have seen him. You would have been proud. I mean, that type uh-huh. of thing.
What off-the-record sessions? Have you done off-the-record sessions with most presidents? And can you tell us about what you learn in an off-the-record session and how they run?
Yes. I mean, the worst. I did one with Ronald Reagan in the White House Library downstairs, which is a great room. And he came in, and they wanted to serve drinks, and the president was drinking a screwdriver,
uh-huh.
and orange juice, and was a vodka. And somebody to break the ice, there were a few other reporters there, said to him, I've got to sit next to you, Mr. President, because I have a bad ear. And the president brightened up and said, oh, I do too, and took his hearing aid out and handed it, wanted each of us to look at his hearing aid. And the last thing I wanted was, you know, to hold the hearing aid that had just been in his ear. But, you know, he's president of the United States, so... You know, you did it, handed it back to him, and
uh-huh.
And then you got into other discussions about, you know, what did he really think about Gorbachev, and and what had happened at the summit. So it's interesting stuff that helps inform your writing. And Reagan was willing to be a little more candid on that. George W. Bush was off the record too. He would, you can say it now. I mean, he at the time thought that he had made a big mistake on how he dealt with Putin, Vladimir Putin, Russia. But he couldn't. He clearly couldn't say that while he was in office, because U.S.-Russian relations were too important. And you know, you had to honor that.
And how many people were in the sessions, say, in that session where he talked about Putin?
In that one, it was during summer, and there were probably, you know, eight other reporters around the table. And I had one with President Clinton where there were six other reporters.
And did everybody honor?
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah. And it was just recently, before President Obama became president, he met with a group of liberal columnists, and I tried like crazy to find out what was said in that, and they all honored it. They wouldn't even tell a a background themselves.
Another question? Yep.
Have you seen any evidence, or do you foresee that we'll see evidence, that a lower level of reporting is going to lead to more corruption, or has led to more corruption amongst our elected officials?
Well, I mean, here's the problem. It's corruption we'll never know about. So it's decisions that will be made in agencies that even newspapers that still staff state capitals have cut back, and so nobody is watching the agency. So it's things you won't know about how your money is being spent. And it's just common sense in human nature that if people know they're not being watched, they're going to cut corners. And we'll never know what those corners were cut. Now, some of it may dribble out, but for the most part, we will never know what is being done and what we're missing.
Well, what about state FOIA laws? There are a lot of states that have strong Freedom of Information Act type statutes that they could use. So it may take some while. So you may find out.
That's the problem.
But it's way later.
I mean, you sometimes don't find out for 8 years the answer on your FOIA request. And there was a story in the Washington Post this past Sunday by the former Baltimore Sun police reporter who did The Wire on HBO, and he tried to get some information out of the Baltimore Police Department about shootings. And even though the law clearly says they have to give that information, the police department refused. So they're not giving it. Nobody is filing the lawsuits the newspapers filed to get this information. And the public sympathy is not with releasing the information, even though it's the public that served. I mean, there's been a tipping of people wanting privacy in all things, and that makes it impossible. When I worked at the Plain Dealer and did police beat, I used to every night call 27 hospitals and talk to the chief nurse and find out what shootings had come in, what cases. That's against the law to give that information now because of the HIPAA law.
Another question?
Does it help or hinder the fact that corruption still continues to go on? Journalists tend to be the first ones to find out about the issue.
I missed the beginning of the question.
The shield laws that should be coming about?
Yes.
Do you like help or hinder the situation of preventing corruption in our government?
Oh, shield laws are definitely a help because if if you have to disclose, if a source knows that you have to disclose his or her name, you know, they want to protect their own livelihood, so they're less likely to come and talk to you. So it's definitely a hindrance not to have those.
Do you think that there will be a federal shield law?
Boy, you know, I have not seen the sentiment in this new Congress to do it. I thought it was going to happen last year.
Uh-huh.
I hope it will this time, but I haven't done any reporting to see whether the
bipartisan support. One of the roles that you've had that we haven't touched on is, although we've mentioned, is that you served as president of the White House Correspondents Association. Can you tell us about the association and what it does?
Well, the association had fallen into sort of disuse and only existed to do the dinner every year, the White House Correspondents Dinner. And in the mid-90s, we tried to reinvigorate it and did, so that it now is the main body that deals with the White House on our working conditions and information and so on. And I was there at the beginning of the Clinton administration when it was just hell, because they tried to clamp down on information. They, on the inauguration day, closed down what's called the upper press office, where you couldn't even go to the press secretary's office. And they fell into one trap that we discovered a lot of new administrations do, where they don't understand the difference between politics and governance. And the example was, one reporter wanted to know what Bible President Clinton was going to take his oath on, his hand on. And they didn't give an answer for a long time on that, because they couldn't quite figure out how to spin it. And they didn't understand reporters didn't want to be spun. Sometimes you just want facts. And that's why the most successful press secretaries understand the difference. Mike McCurry and Marlon Fitzwater, who were one Republican, one Democrat, understood that you're there to serve the public and to serve, and just say, here's the policy, here's what the policy does, and leave the spinning to other people. Now, they could spin when it was required, but they also understood that. And some press secretaries that I could mention just never quite got that it was governance now. This isn't the campaign.
Uh-huh.
You know, we talk about a perpetual campaign, but the public deserves governance also.
Right.
So the Correspondents Association deals with those, everything from the seating to
in the briefing room,
to fighting for access. And one of the things that we fight for is the public doesn't believe us in a lot of things. Our credibility is not high, so we don't like to put things on background. I had to do a story last week advancing the president's speech, and I needed a quote from the administration on what the president hoped to get out of it. And this is pretty boilerplate stuff. It was, the president's going to talk about the economic challenge facing the country and how we get out of it. And the administration person I was talking to insisted it had to be on background. Worthless. I mean, why would you put something like that on background? Mm-hmm. There's no secrets or anything, but that's their nature. Everything has to be on background. And people look at that and say, oh, well, you made that up. Nobody really said that. So we didn't use the quotes. So you're continually sort of educating them on that.
Do you think that in a lot of administrations, they want to use background because they think that it means that they're going to get attention, and their president doesn't want them to have attention? Is that one of the major reasons?
I don't know if it's a major reason. It's also to protect themselves from getting in trouble. But my favorite story on that was in 1983, Ronald Reagan went down to Cancun, and it was a big world summit, developing and developed countries, a so-called North-South summit. And Secretary of State Alexander Haig briefed us in the White House hotel, and they had ground rules that he had to be identified as a senior administration official, not Secretary of State. Well, the local Mexican newspaper didn't quite understand American rules. So their story said, senior administration official says this about Mexico. Then in boldface, before the story started, it said, U.S. Secretary of State Alexander Haig briefed reporters, but we had to identify him by rule as senior administration official. So in this story, the senior administration official is Secretary of State Haig. And then the whole story just said senior administration official. And they weren't being cute. They just didn't understand American rules, and they were trying to explain it. So,
and
what happened? We've had briefings that I've attended where the White House press secretary, Marilyn Fitzwater, was briefing us and then said, okay, on camera, live TV, he said, okay, now we're going to go on background and so-and-so will talk to us. So even though he had announced on live TV who the briefer was, we had to, in our stories, say senior administration official.
Uh-huh. Well, that
gets silly.
And that happened in this administration when they brought out a senior administration official to talk about the executive orders on Guantanamo. Yeah. And the name throughout was people were referring to him as Greg. And even the press secretary later on said the briefing that you had this morning with Greg Craig.
Yeah. I mean, it's why
it was the White House counsel.
Why people think we operate on very strange rules in Washington, as we do.
What other kinds of things do you do? What's the dinner involve, and what has been the what have been some of the issues that have come around about the dinner?
Oh well, I mean, the same. I don't have a lot of patience for some of the criticism of the dinner.
Uh-huh.
The same people who used to always criticize the dinner as being too boring because all we had was public officials there are now complaining that it's too Hollywood because a lot of Hollywood stars like to come to it. You know, it's a mix. It's fun, and it's helpful to you on news because you can. There are people who wouldn't normally return my calls that I can walk up to at a reception and talk to.
Right.
So you can develop people as sources,
right,
and you can have fun.
Yeah.
So I mean,
And it's a good place to get commitments on interviews.
Yeah. Now, I will admit that last year at the dinner, I got trampled a couple of times because I was two tables over from the Jonas Brothers. And there were more people interested in talking to the Jonas Brothers than me. Go figure.
Another question?
Do you view yourself as a reporter or an investigator? And what are the biggest challenges and limitations you have in finding information?
You know, every reporter is an investigative reporter. You know, you're always trying to get to the bottom of things. That doesn't mean you're going to put people in prison, but if you can investigate why a policy was formed, and that's a service. I mean, people are reporters because they like asking questions. I mean, I loved being a reporter in high school because I could go up to the principal and ask why something was done. And the average student didn't have that kind of access. So, you know, I can go up to a mayor, a governor. That's a tremendous thing, and you should honor that by asking questions that you think people either would ask if they were in your place or should ask. And the biggest hurdles are, two things. One, it's harder and harder to talk to actual policymakers now because there's so many barriers now, so many people that between you and the people you want to talk to. And the other thing is, you know, the drive for more and more privacy and keeping things that should be public record away from us. I mean, again, go back to the example that was in the Washington Post about the Baltimore Police Department. I mean, they have succeeded in keeping information about police shootings out of the public record. If there's anything that should be public record, it's when there's a police shooting and somebody loses their life. You cannot now find out whether or not this was the fifth police shooting by that policeman. You know, that doesn't serve the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What we were talking about press secretaries a little while ago. What do you said you expected them to tell the truth. What other kinds of things do you expect them to do in terms both of being facilitators of information, like hooking you up with people who are knowledgeable about issues, and also in their briefings? Can you talk about both of those kinds of things?
Well, I want them to get back to you. I want them to be responsive. I mean, I have enormous respect for a good press secretary. For one thing, I don't think most reporters would make good press secretaries. It's much different skill set. But the hours that they have to work, Robert Gibbs is at the White House by 6 a.m. every day. He rarely leaves before 7:30, and he does that every day. He's got a family at home, a 5-year-old son that he hardly ever sees. He has to take flack from us. And you have to know so much more than I know. Than almost anybody else knows, because any topic can come up, and he has to know something about it beyond just casual knowledge. He has to know what he can say and can't say, and if he just says something a little bit wrong, he can affect the stock market, the value of the dollar, U.S. relations with other countries, the lives of service members. Mm-hmm. Intelligence officials. I mean, there's a lot of burden mm-hmm. on a press secretary, mm-hmm. Beyond just answering some questions.
How useful do you find the press secretary's daily briefing?
Actually, I find it's helpful. There are issues that come up there where he can't possibly field the same question from each one of us. I mean, that's all he'd be doing all day. And there's some questions that all of us want to know the answer to. Mm-hmm. It shows you the evolution of policy. I find them sometimes less uh-huh. helpful. But And in the eighth year of an administration, you wouldn't catch me near a briefing. Uh-huh. I don't think.
I think that happened I know it happened in the eighth year of President Bush's administration. One day, President Bush, his press office announced, I think it was in January or February of 2008, that he and Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, were coming into the briefing room, and they didn't give much notice. Yeah. And so I think they notified people. I was there when the notice was sent through the PA system, and I think it was at 2:13, and then he was coming out. The two of them were coming out at 2:35. Yeah. And so it didn't give time for people to sprint to the White House, get through the Northwest Gate, and get into the briefing room. So the only people who were there in that room, and there are 49 seats in the room, and I'd say at a typical briefing today, there are probably about 80 people at the briefing. Yeah. And that particular day, when the president himself came in with his Treasury secretary, there were 18 people in the seats, and that was it. And that is what happens in the eighth year. And now we're seeing what happens in the first year, and particularly when there is a great deal of policy on the table, because there are an enormous number of people.
Yeah. Actually, that the one complaint that I do have about the new administration came up because they gave so much notice before his first press conference. It was announced, I think, on Thursday. You signed up on Saturday, and it was Monday night.
Yeah.
There was a blurring of the line between reporters and partisans that was troubling. I mean, I was not upset that Huffington Post was. I mean, you could quibble on that, but to have in the first row of a primetime presidential press conference a very partisan talk show host, Ed Schaefer. And it didn't cause it didn't cause a big fuss because almost nobody in the country knows him. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just got his name wrong.
Uh-huh.
But it should have been criticized. If President Bush had had Sean Hannity in a front row seat at his press conference, there would have been howls. There would have been protests. You're ruining this. But, you know, there was a double standard here. It should have been criticized. You know, a press conference is not a place for partisan hacks.
Uh-huh.
Not a place for somebody who wants to get up and say, you know, Mr. President, why are you so wonderful?
Do you think that they just hadn't thought through how you set up one of those? Differences.
I think they're very taken with the idea of, you know, new media versus old media, and you know, we won this campaign in part because we understood, you know, that there's a changing environment, and,
uh-huh.
and because they played to,
yeah.
you know, the new media. They did it very effectively, and they should have. Again, it's a difference between governance when you're in the White House and politics to get in there.
If you looked at the people that President Obama called on in that press conference, he called on the very same people or institutions, the same news organizations that that Bush very regularly called on. He called on The Wires, AP, Reuters, and Bloomberg, Five Nets, New York Times, Washington Post.
Right.
He did not call on the Wall Street Journal or USA Today.
Right.
Called Huffington Post was the one that was different, and NPR, Mara Liasson, and Helen Thomas, and put her pretty high up.
Yeah, no, I have no problem with that. I mean, it's a little troubling that it's so completely scripted now. On, I mean, every president has had it scripted on at least the first few that he called on. This is the first one where you have the sense that every single one was scripted.
Although it's unclear to me, I know that during the campaign they let people know that they were going to be called on, and that was not the case with that press conference. Although there was an article in the Washington Post, Howard Kurtz wrote that they knew that the reporters had been informed that they had been called on, but I didn't find one reporter.
I don't think they were informed,
and I don't either. And that was not corrected, and so what happens is that's just now, and they doesn't seem to me that the Obama press office tried to stop it either, because it's now become conventional wisdom that that's the way things work, and I think in fact it really isn't, but you also could anticipate what kinds of questions that people were going to ask. another question? Yep.
Which president that you personally worked with was effective portraying his message to the media, where the people were basically like, okay, I believe him, or just went along with him? I know, I mean, whether you agree with Bush or not, I know a lot of just the media ate him up a lot, like, you know, regardless of what anybody believes in him, but what the president you worked with was able to really get his message out to where the people just bought it.
There was a reason why Ronald Reagan was called the great communicator. I mean, he did it in very simple terms. You knew what he believed in, and he explained it in a way that everybody could get. Now, that didn't mean everybody bought into it. When the unemployment hit 10%, in 1982, he got clobbered in the midterm elections, and through 83, it looked like he was going to be a one-term president and a failure. The economy turned around, and he won a landslide in 84 and had a successful presidency. So, I mean, if your policies don't work, no matter how good a communicator you are, it's the old, you know, you can do the great advertising on the dog food, but if the dogs don't like it, doesn't matter how well you communicate it. Bill Clinton was a very good communicator, except he tried to communicate too many things too many issues, and that diffused it. And plus, his own personal indiscretions got in the way of the message sometime. I did not think that Bush was a particularly good communicator.
Yeah, he seemed not to be interested in explaining.
Yeah, right.
What he did, that he liked making decisions, but he didn't like explaining them. And he didn't have other people do that. So he didn't do it, and his press secretaries weren't in power to do it either. And so you just didn't get a lot of explanation.
Yeah. And part of it is also whether you build confidence. I was just talking to my father last night, who I said is 92, and he was talking about how just listening to Franklin Roosevelt's voice during the Depression gave confidence to people. And that's important. So it's more than just what you say. Mm-hmm. There was another hand back there.
Yeah. Somewhere. In the back, somebody had a hand up back in the back.
I was wondering, you said that you said your father wrote a book too. Do you think that you'll be interested in writing one also about everything you've been through?
Well, actually, my father's written, I think, 12 books. My father is probably the leading historian of the city of Cleveland. He's written several histories of Cleveland and Ohio and the Erie Canal and so on. And I've co-authored one book. We did a book on the Cunningham case. So I enjoy it, but it has to be something that I really want to write. I felt the Cunningham book was important because as the biggest case of congressional corruption in history, we wanted an authoritative an account of it for historians. We had no illusions that it was going to, outsell Harry Potter, but we wanted it there for history.
And you won the Pulitzer Prize for it.
Well, not for the book.
For your coverage.
The coverage, right.
Yeah. Another? Any others?
Yeah, we got one. So after 9/11, it seemed that the press corps went along with a lot of policies that Bush had, forced the war and forced terrorism, and a lot of his policies weren't checked, from what I believe, during the press. Do you think that this current administration is under scrutiny now because of the failed administration to, relive a policy that were not checked through the media?
There's a couple of answers to that. One, I think you're right in the wake of 9/11. I mean, there were questions that were not raised about the linkage between the war in Iraq and 9/11. They were raised by some people, and everybody points to accurately the Knight Ridder stories were very skeptical. But, we're supposed to be skeptical and not by the party line, and in too many cases, and I think the New York Times was the worst offender, we went along. And actually, that's one of the problems in the reduction of Washington coverage here by so many newspapers. They say, why should we spend money on it? We pay money for the New York Times. Well, guess what? The New York Times is not always right. We all ran their coverage in San Diego and elsewhere about the war, and it was wrong. With Obama, I don't think that the scrutiny is coming because of what happened with Bush as much as it is, it's natural, it's in our nature, and you have, because especially on cable TV, there was a tilt toward Obama in the coverage. I mean, watching MSNBC was embarrassing, going after Hillary and defending Obama. It did go over the line, and that's on this level. I'm at a reporting level down here. We all are aware of that, and all the conservatives think we're completely in Obama's pocket, and he's the Messiah, and so on. And you're human. You react to that. You want to show that you're not in, on the payroll. But that doesn't mean you take shots when they're not deserved, but you certainly are tough.
One more.
We wore him out.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much, George. I really appreciate it. That was very good.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you.